Okay, so this week
we are getting into
sort of the heart of Christian apologetics. Okay, sort of the heart of Christian apologetics. What I think is the heart of Christian apologetics. And so we talked a little bit about prophecy a couple weeks ago, and taking a look at prophetic proofs and using prophecy and accompanying signs as evidence for the reliability of the speaker, of the messenger, right? This week, we need to talk about what I think is the sign or the proof above all proofs, right? The proof par excellence, and that's the resurrection. And what I want to do is I want to talk about it in history. So what I want to do this week is talk about how we can talk about the resurrection historically, right? And what can we say about the resurrection historically? What can't we say about it, right? And I think, well, just to kind of signal the end, I think we can get from the evidence, we can at least show that the resurrection is plausible from a historical perspective, if not probable, right? Probably can't prove it because we don't have anything direct on it. I think that's actually a lot more than some people would give it credit for, right? So just real briefly, I wanted to lay out some of the issues that people will bring up when we're talking about whether or not Jesus actually rose from the dead, right? So one question that I think is important to at least address, even though I don't think it needs a lot of our time, is did Jesus exist in history? There are some people, not necessarily people within the academic guild. You'll see that there is a when it comes to discussing this kind of stuff, there's a wide variety of people that comment on this. So if you go put a Google search in, you'll find a wide variety of voices, right? Within the actual academic discussions, This is not really a live question, but I want to address it just briefly, right? Okay. Second is, what do we know about Jesus' life? Okay, so what can we say with confidence about Jesus, right, from a historical perspective? So we're not taking a look at this from a scriptural perspective or faith perspective. We're taking a look at this from a historical perspective, right?
Number three, what did the early Christians say about Jesus?
So that's kind of the third question that I think is important to address when we're taking a look at this historically, right? So now, not just what do we know about Jesus, but what did the early Christians say about him, all right? And and we'll actually take a look at this from two separate perspectives. But these are kind of the three questions that I think are important when we're asking historically, right? What's going on? So I'm going to just sort of line out each of these three questions as we move through, right? Talk about some of the ins and outs, and talk a little bit about historical method, right? A little bit about historical method. Okay, so. First question, did Jesus exist in I knew it, Mindy. I would just get a chance to lay out the problem. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so
did Jesus exist in history?
So the first place that you would typically think to go to think about did Jesus exist in history is the New Testament, right? It's the New Testament. But have you all come across people who have said, well, how can we trust what's in the Bible? Right? I mean, you say, like, you're using the Bible, but how do you trust what's in the Bible? Okay? I'm going to talk about the Bible as a historical document here in just a little bit. But before we get to that, there are a couple things that I wanted to, and I need to pull this back up on my, well, I'm probably going to have to log back in. Yeah. Well, there's two sources that I think give us unequivocal mentions of Jesus as a historical figure outside of any Christian writings, okay? Outside of any Christian writings. And those are Josephus is a Jewish historian, okay? He's a Jewish historian, and without quoting him directly, from Josephus we have evidence both of Jesus as a sort of revolutionary figure in Judea around the turn of the first century. And then we also have evidence of James, or Jacob, mentioned as Jesus's brother. Okay. So there's a passage where James is mentioned as Jesus's brother in an offhand manner, right? In an offhand manner, actually when Josephus is talking about somebody else. And then we have direct testimony from Josephus about Jesus in a passage in which Josephus is writing about the history of Judea at the time. It sounds very Christian. Okay, and it's almost 100% likely that this passage has been doctored by Christians, that Christians took a manuscript of Josephus and inserted sections into Josephus's little blurb about Jesus that made Josephus sound like he was a Christian. Probably wasn't, right? Probably wasn't. But most scholars believe that we can figure out where Josephus stops and where the Christian interpolations begin. And it's still pretty clear that Josephus considered Jesus sort of uncontroversially to be an actual figure, somebody who lived and led a revolutionary movement in Judea around the turn of the first century. Okay. The next one that we have is a Roman historian called Tacitus. All right, Tacitus. And the funny thing about Tacitus is he mentions a revolt in Rome that is also mentioned in Acts. And he talks about the people that were involved in the in sort of the punishment, the scapegoats of this were people who followed a guy named Crestus, who was executed as a political prisoner in Judea, right? It's pretty clear Tacitus, he's right, he is part of the Roman intelligentsia at the time, right? Almost everybody is sure that when Tacitus misspells the name Christ, that he's talking about Jesus Christ. Everything else lines up, right? This is a persecution that broke out in Rome around the time of Nero. around the same time that we see this mentioned in the book of Acts. Once again, Tacitus is he is not living in he's not living in Judea, first century Judea at the time, but he once again considers this an uncontroversial claim that there is a person who took the title of Christ or something close to it, right? Who lived in Judea around the turn of the first century and was executed as a political prisoner, right? So these are two, and the thing that's interesting about this is both of these sources are people that are writing histories, okay, and they don't seem to care about any sort of controversy over the understanding of Jesus as a person who lived at the time and who was a revolutionary at the time, right? If you go online and Google this, you will still find people who say that Jesus was some sort of like mythical figure. He was understood by Christians to be some sort of spiritual being, and never, you know, all of these, everything in the New Testament is written as some sort of like allegory, or, you know, it's sort of myth making, kind of the same way that Gilgamesh would be or something like that, right? But I just don't think, and we'll get to the New Testament here as a historical document in just a bit, but I also just don't think that you have to do some major backflips in your thinking to be able to get around sort of offhand comments that line up with everything else that we know historically from the time, right? So I actually think outside of certain circles, and I'll just say, I've interacted with some of these people online, and they are exhausting, right? They are exhausting, right? You all, everybody understands this now, that there are just some people who have, who are constantly fueled by online fights, right? And they have no ability to log off. There are some people in it that call themselves like they've made themselves this own community dedicated to showing that Jesus never even was a historical person. But at this point, I just don't think it's a live question. I just think it's not even an interesting historical question. Not just because of Josephus and Tacitus giving us sort of hard dates and an uncontroversial acceptance of Jesus as a historical figure, right? It just doesn't even make sense that they would talk about Jesus this way. But also, the New Testament as a historical document, its self-understanding is that Jesus lived and died and rose again, right? Yeah, Mark?
Wasn't there some writings in Chinese history, even though they weren't around the crucifixion or anything, that there was a darkening during the day that was unexplainable and an earthquake?
I'm not sure about that. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah.
I knew something happened, I just didn't know what was causing it.
Yeah. Right. There is, now there is a, we'll talk, I'll talk a little bit about some opponents to Christianity that had counter explanations for some of those same things, Mark, for the darkness and the, and the earthquake, some of the signs around. But I'm not aware in China, but I know that there were early opponents of Christianity that tried to offer counter explanations for some of those phenomena. Okay, so I think we can lay this I actually think we can lay this question to bed, right? I really do. So the question for us is, how much can we use the New Testament to give us historical information, right? Not just theological information, not just information for the church, right? Spiritual information, but how much can we use the New Testament for historical information? Okay? Now, sometimes this is a little bit of a slippery question, and I think it's something that we don't talk about a whole lot in church, because if you think we're going to try to subject the New Testament to historical critical examination, it's going to make it, for a lot of people, it sort of offends the way that you read the Bible, because we read the Bible spiritually, devotionally, right? Or theologically, right? Which are all valid and important things for us to do as a church. We have to get theology from the New Testament, right? That's kind of what we do. So the question that we're asking here is kind of, we're having to take sideways looks at the text, right? To be able to figure out what kind of historical information can we mine from the text itself, right? And pretty much everybody thinks we can do that, right? There is wide agreement based on the manuscripts that we have, and based on the language and the historical situation reflected in most of the New Testament writings, that all of this is written before 100 AD, right? So actually, let me just get that down. So New Testament documents, New Testament is written by 100 AD. Right. So that's there will be people that will dispute a certain book here or there, but basically everybody thinks that by around the turn of the second century AD, everything that is written in the New Testament has been written down and is being circulated widely in the church. All right.
Is there any controversy about whether the people that wrote them existed?
No, not I mean, really.
They're historical figures, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's lots. Well, there is some discussion, controversy over whether certain letters that are attributed to Paul were actually written by Paul, or whether they were written by like a student of Paul, somebody in Paul's school. But the interesting thing about that is the main way that people will argue for a letter like, say, Ephesians to not have been written by Paul is to say that the contents in Ephesians, like the writing style and the themes addressed, don't line up well with the language and the style and the themes of a letter like, say, Galatians or Romans. And those are sort of the undisputed Pauline letters, right? Now, I don't want to get into that discussion right now. There's lots of different explanations for style and difference in from Galatians to Ephesians, right? But the interesting thing is, even critical scholars think that we can detect the voice of Paul, the author, right? We can detect the authorial voice of Paul within basically Galatians and Thessalonians and Romans and Corinthians. So even somebody who would hold to something that would be uncomfortable for most of us, right? That let's say 2 Timothy is somebody writing for Paul or writing in Paul's stead or something, right? The reason they could say that is because they would say, I'm saying this because I know Paul's voice from Romans, Corinthians, Galatians, right? So even in the most critical, most skeptical circles, Paul is a historical figure, and a historical figure that from whom we can have a reasonable grasp of his authorial voice, right? So, and that's actually really important because we're going to get to 1 Corinthians 15 in just a little bit. So actually, Ben, that was a good question. I'm going to move forward on that because the key thing that historians want, right, when you're building your history, is you want primary sources. I know Sophia would roll her eyes right now if I was talking about primary sources. We've had to go over this in social studies a few times. But primary sources are, you want to hear from people who were there, right? That's the whole key. You want to hear from people who were there. And the reason that the New Testament now should is counted by most people as our number one source for historical information about Jesus, is that the New Testament contains primary sources, people who were there. Okay? And so if we have people who are giving their own personal testimony, this now counts as a historical document. All right? Now, we can still assess a primary source critically, right? Just because somebody was there and they tell you something happened, it doesn't necessarily mean that we can trust them, that they are reliable, okay? But when we're trying to figure out how to do the history of Jesus, our best historical information comes from the New Testament because the New Testament contains primary sources. For instance, I think, and most scholars who are doing this, who are doing the resurrection, the history of the history of the resurrection, would say is 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 through 7. All right, 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 through 7. So let me read that, because this is, I'm glad you asked that question, Ben, because everybody agrees that 1 Corinthians is Paul, that we're reading Paul's words in 1 Corinthians, right? This isn't something that's been compiled. This isn't necessarily something that's been edited through, that we are reading Paul's words here in 1 Corinthians, who lived in the middle of the second half, who lived in the first century, and he is relaying his firsthand experience to the churches within these letters, right? So, let me start in verse 1. Now I would remind you, brothers, of the gospel I preached to you, which you received, in which you stand, and by which you are being saved, if you hold fast to the word I preached to you, unless you believed in vain. So now Paul is giving a summary of the preaching that he gave to the Corinthians, right? For I delivered to you as first importance what I also received. We're going to talk about the received here in just a bit too. That Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, that's going to be important, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me. For I am the least of the apostles, unworthy to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. Okay, so here Paul is giving he's basically giving, when you're thinking about, have you all been encouraged to give like an elevator speech of like your life or testimony, or maybe even talking about like a business pitch or something, your elevator speech, right? This is Paul's elevator speech, right? And in this, there are some interesting things, okay? So if we're looking at this historically, from this passage, we can see that, use a different pen here, we can see that Paul preached in Corinth.
I know this seems inane, but it's going to be important, okay?
He preached in Corinth prior to sending this letter, right? He preached in Corinth prior to sending this letter. We can take a look at, and we can sort of cross-reference Paul's missionary journey. This would be his second missionary journey in Acts, right? And so we can actually take a look at Paul's preaching in Corinth here, line it up with Paul's itinerary in Acts, and we can get a date. About 50 AD, give or take. We can put a date on Paul's preaching. And so this preaching and the correspondence, based on the language, based on the fact that this is a first-hand account, uncontroversially, it's a first-hand account, taking a look at the development of the church in Corinth later on, which we'll talk about when we meet again, the growth of the church. Paul here is preaching in Corinth about 50 AD, right? Now, the other thing that's really interesting is Paul's talking about his preaching, right, which he gave to the Corinthians after his untimely birth, right, in verse 9, after his untimely birth. But it's also the preaching that in verse 3 that Paul received the gospel message. So we can also see that Paul received this message as well. So when Paul is giving the when Paul is giving this gospel message in verses 3 through 7, right, the sort of the core of Jesus' resurrection, the core of Jesus' resurrection message, he says that this that I'm giving to you is something that I received as well. Okay. And where did he receive it? Probably in Jerusalem. And this would have to be prior to 50 AD. How much prior? It's tough to say, right? But what we're probably reading here is an early Christian creed. I mean, it's got meter, it's got rhythm, it's got parallelism in verses 3 through 7. It's probably an early Christian creed that Paul had received, you know, like an early catechism, an early creed that Paul had received when he met with the leaders of the church in Jerusalem. That's why the received is so important there, right? This isn't Paul's own personal revelation that he got in the desert or on the way to Damascus. This is the public message that the church is preaching, right? It's the public message that the church is preaching. And so so this has to be somewhere between 30... it's got to be somewhere between 35 to 45 AD. if we're going to account for Paul traveling to Jerusalem and Paul's travel to Corinth and the correspondence here. So if this is Paul reporting firsthand a Christian creed in 1 Corinthians 15, which it looks like it is, most people agree that it is, this is universally agreed that Paul is delivering this message, right? Then there are people living in Jerusalem between 35 and 45 AD that are saying this thing, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and he appeared to Cephas, not Peter, right? He appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom were alive, though some had fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all of the apostles. Last of all, and that last of all, Paul's adding on himself, right? That's probably not part of the original creed. But here is some, if we're looking for a historical marker, right? If we're talking about history, looking at a historical marker, here in 1 Corinthians 15, this is the information, the historical information that is probably the most key to understanding the resurrection in history, okay? Because we are now pushing a primary source, right? So now the New Testament is not, you don't have to think about it as a document that is like a preaching document. You don't have to think about it as a spiritual document or a theological document. Historically, what we have, particularly in 1 Corinthians 15, is a primary source that we can date with reasonable certainty, right? Not 100% certainty, but we can date this with reasonable certainty. So the question is then, what did the early Christians say about Jesus? Okay? What did the early Christians say about Jesus? Okay? So
I have just one thing to that always struck me was that if Paul said that, people are still alive that know whether it's true or not.
Yeah.
He would have just ruined his entire credibility if
yeah.
he would have said it and it wasn't true. And
yeah.
He knew that. So,
yeah.
That was one that always made me think that's, it's real. Because they would have said you're a liar and you would have been
right.
disbanded.
From right. Yeah. It's actually really interesting. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time getting into some of the certain details, but some scholars who look at this and agree that verse 6 there, that appearing to more than 500 brothers, some of whom are still alive, it suggests that you can go talk to them. You can ask them about it, right? So, in order to explain the existence of that in the creed, there's a lot of people that have looked into public religious phenomena where people in groups claim to have like a group apparition or hallucination or something. Just so like, I mean, I'm telling you, in the literature, there is extensive discussion about whether or not you can have a group hallucination, believe it or not. Because of that verse, right? Because of that verse.
Haven't they determined that's not possible?
Yeah, I don't think it's possible, yeah. Yeah.
If it was a hallucination, it would be...
Yeah, I don't think...
Do you have women, too? Yeah. Do you have women? Bye, guys.
Yeah, so I I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on the group hallucination thing because I think it's kind of silly. if you're unsettled by the implications of it, then you're going to find ways around it.
Can we try to have one?
Yeah.
Find some peyote.
Yeah.
Just drink the Kool-Aid, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, so what did then the early Christians say about Jesus? What are some of the things that we can say with reasonable certainty that that we know then, using the New Testament as primary source now, right? I'm not even talking about the parables as historical artifacts. I'm not talking about anything else like this. The only thing I want to focus on then is what are the sort of basic things that we can say about Jesus, especially with respect to the resurrection, right? So there's a few things that we can say with reasonable certainty.
Okay. I'll use letters here.
Okay. So here's the things that we can say with not just probability, almost to the point of proof, right?
Jesus was crucified around 33 AD under Pilate.
We can say that with
are you recording this?
Yeah.
You're gonna put it out there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
You gotta do the doors.
Oh, you all gotta do the doors too. Okay. So we can say that with pretty reasonable certainty, right? We have Pilate attested in inscriptions. We have the high priest Caiaphas attested in inscriptions at the time, and we have extra biblical attestation of Jesus being crucified, and the New Testament as a primary source. One of the key events that the New Testament relates is Jesus' crucifixion, right? Everything lines up, right? You have to basically deny everything that we know about history to deny that Jesus was crucified under Pilate, right? So we know that for sure, right? I'm confident. I'm almost 100% confident, historically speaking, that I can prove that Jesus was crucified under Pilate, right?
The next thing. Christians claimed to have seen Jesus risen.
That is another 100% confidence thing that we can say. And we can pretty much date the formulation of that creed to within about a decade, right? We can date it to within about a decade, historically speaking. All right? Next thing.
Opponents of Christians claimed to have experiences of risen Jesus.
Okay, and this specifically here, I'm talking about two people. Unequivocally, we can say with 100% confidence that Paul thought of himself as an opponent of the church. He had an experience with Jesus, the risen Jesus, and began preaching the same message that was being preached by the Jerusalem church. Okay? This is unequivocal. I actually think that these three things historically are absolutely unassailable. There is no reasonable historical examination of the New Testament that denies any of these three things. And I'm talking about opponents in plural. The one that we can say for sure is Paul, right? Because we have Paul's firsthand testimony. He claims to have been an opponent, and now he is preaching that Jesus is risen from the dead, right? The other person that's significant in this is James, right? So in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 7, Jesus appeared to James, right? This is significant as well. We don't have a primary source account of James's conversion, so it's not as established. But James, as the brother of Jesus, it's really interesting that James is in the church, right? Somebody who presumably grew up with Jesus, who is universally recognized to be a brother of Jesus. Not only in the New Testament, but by Josephus as well. Somebody who lived and grew up with Jesus is proclaiming him as the risen Lord and is a key figure, a key leader in the Jerusalem church early on. Right? We know that from Acts and then the letter attributed to him as well shows the importance of James within the early church, even if we don't have a firsthand account of his experience with Jesus or of his conversion, right? Okay, so these three things are unassailable. I'm going to use a different color for this because it's not quite as unassailable, but I still think it should factor in. Let me put it like this, and then it is unassailable. There is an empty tomb tradition in both the creeds and archaeology of Jerusalem. And here I'm talking about the existence of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is within the bounds of Old City Jerusalem today, but during the time of Jesus would have been outside the city walls proper, right? If you read John carefully, it lets us know that the tomb was actually not very far away from the city itself, and that's why the disciple whom Jesus loved and Peter were able to run there so quickly, probably from Bethany, just coming over the Mount of Olives and and then to the side of the city to get to the tomb, right? And so we have tradition of Christian pilgrimage to the site of the empty tomb going back into the first century. Okay? So Christians, even from, within the first century, Christians are coming to this site just outside of Jerusalem as pilgrimage. All right? We have, so, and this is, once again, this is historical record, right? So not only is the empty tomb key in the gospel narratives, it's understood here, it's implied here that in 1 Corinthians 15 that Jesus was buried and he was raised on the third day. That assumes the empty tomb, right? And we have evidence of Christians revering this site, right? Coming to this site to pilgrimage as early as the first century. Okay, so I'm pretty sure that we can say that the early church thought that and preached that, especially the Jerusalem church. We know where the tomb was where Jesus was supposed to have been buried, and he's not there. Right? So this is historical bedrock. Right? I'm getting that term from Mike Lacona. If you want to look up Mike Lacona.
He's got some really good Michael Licona.
He's probably done the most extensive recent work on this. But when you take these things together, now when you're trying to build a theory, a historical theory that ties all of these facts together, that explains all of these facts, right? Which I think, I personally think these four facts are unassailable in history, right? So what hypothesis can we come up with that explains these facts, right? Now, you can come up with lots of hypotheses, but which one best explains all of these facts? And so, to me, this is the question when we're talking about trying to understand the trying to understand the resurrection historically. The key question is, what hypotheses are you willing to entertain about explaining these facts? Most people either say, if you're sort of writing and trying to bracket theology out of this, most people will say, we just don't know. Right? Early Christians had some sort of religious experience that caused them to believe that Jesus was risen from the dead. Right? And just leave it ambiguous like that, right? I think that ambiguity is very difficult to maintain when we have multiple accounts of opponents of Christians who claim to have similar experiences and took up the same messaging, right? And not only that, but they submitted themselves to the authority of the Jerusalem church, right? And Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 here is assuming that his message has also been authorized by the Jerusalem church, that he's not preaching of his own accord, right? The other thing that I think is tough is we have a place where Christians were going. You know, we have a place where Christians were going, and the tradition of the empty tomb is so Christians aren't revering the place where they may have had this religious experience. Christians are revering the place where they claim that Jesus was risen from the dead. Right? So much so that, and this tradition was so persistent that when Constantine's mother Helena came through, people easily pointed out where the Romans had built a temple over top of this pilgrimage site in order to discourage Christian pilgrimage, which she then tore down and built the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, right? So all of these together, I'm convinced, and that's one of the reasons I'm here teaching at a church. I'm convinced that the best explanation of these is Jesus was risen from the dead by God. God raised Jesus from the dead as a confirmation of Jesus' message about himself, right? And that's the simplest way to explain everything that happens after Jesus' crucifixion. These things that happen in the immediate aftermath, which we can date with confidence prior to 50 AD. Now, let me say one thing that I think is really interesting about this historical look. When you're doing this historical study, it can feel like you're sort of dissecting the Bible a little bit and you're not reading it theologically. And sometimes if you're trying to put a historical critical lens on the Bible, there are conclusions that you might come to that would be uncomfortable for people's view of Scripture, right? But what I think is so powerful about this approach, right? We're not arguing for everything in the New Testament. We're not arguing for inerrancy or infallibility in the New Testament here. What we're arguing for is a historical thing that happened, right? And if we can show with, I think these facts make it at least plausible, right, that Jesus rose from the dead. It's at least plausible. Probably, when you try to figure out how to fit these pieces together, the most probable missing piece is Jesus' resurrection. I think you can get it up to probability. Probably can't get it to proof, right? Because we don't have anything from the time that we don't have newspaper clippings from the time ring door footage, ring camera footage from somebody saying, "Do you see Jesus walking by?" We don't have anything like that. So probably can't get to proof, right? So there's still a little bit of room for trust in the message, right? But I think we can actually get it to probability. And if this happened, and if this is something that probably happened in history, right, historically speaking, if it's in history, something that happened, then there's nothing that can change that, right? It's inalterable. Right? If this is something that happened in history, this is something that we can put our faith in, because you can't come back and change something that happened in history. And I think this year, Jesus' resurrection, confirming his ministry, confirming his prophetic status, and confirming his claim to be the Messiah, is the event that gives us the reason to trust in the rest of Jesus' message. Right? What he says about himself, what he says about God, and to take his words and what the church and how the church processed Jesus' teachings and his life as a sure prophetic foundation for our teaching, for our theology, for our doctrine, all of those things. So I actually think that this is sort of the heart of how we should talk about Christianity, right? I don't know that this is a message that preaches 100% like on a street corner, you know? Because you know, you're having to take away a lot of assumptions, and some of it can get very technical, right? but I do think that this to me, when I process through my own personal faith crisis, the anchor that sort of kept me tethered to God was creation and looking at creation, right? But the thing that gave me confidence again in Scripture, right, and in the message of the church, was a historical examination of these facts. And honestly, looking at the alternative hypotheses that are given, whether it's some sort of nebulous religious experience, a group hallucination, right? None of those fit this pattern of facts. The way that just saying that, you know, what the early church said is what happened, right? That to me is what renewed my confidence in calling myself a Christian and putting trust in the gospel message. So, that's the resurrection in history. You all have questions or thoughts on that?
I know only what I missed in the beginning, but I'll have you go through it again just because.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've got it recorded here. I'll put it up. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
A lot of references, you know, really reliable sources. They were writing in their history about this event that coincided with the crucifixion, that, you know, there were these events like darkness,
yeah,
in the middle of the day, and, you know, earthquakes. And they didn't know that Christ was being crucified at the time, but their history, independent of that, documents this happening. Mm-hmm. Something happens.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, big. They're astronomers documented.
Yeah.
And to me, that just, I mean, it's like, how could this happen?
Right.
If it wasn't supernatural, if it really didn't exist.
Right. Well, I'll just give, I didn't have time to get to this, but one of the early opponents of Christianity, his name was Celsus, C-E-L-S-U-S, if you want to read it. We don't actually have his writings, but he's quoted by an early church father named Origen, okay? Yeah. but Celsus, he accepted the existence of, he accepted that there was, a darkening in the sky. But he just attributed it to an eclipse. And Origen gives arguments for why an eclipse doesn't fit, right? So, but anyways, when we're talking about history, a lot of times, and like I said, this isn't really in what I wanted to talk about. But when we're talking about history and understanding history, like writing about history, half of it is what is the thing that happened. But the other half of history is, what does it mean? What's the significance of this thing that happened? So it could be something like Origen and Celsus arguing over whether the darkness in the sky was supernatural or whether it was an eclipse, right? I mean, it could be both.
That's where the astronomers in China were documenting this. They didn't have any, you know, there was no
right
marker. There was an eclipse.
Yeah.
There was something else.
Yeah. But I think it's just as true when we're taking a look at these things about these things around Jesus' life. You know, these things happened. How do we explain them, right? And what's the significance of them?
As far as like historical records go, I was told, I forget who I was talking to, but they told me that the earliest records that we have of this are from actually Saudi Arabia or Iraq.
Uh-huh.
Like,
are you talking about the darkness in the sky?
No, like just biblical record. Like, so like physical manuscripts.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Alexandria thought Ray burned down in like 70, right? Something like
that. Yeah.
Around
yeah.
time. So we don't have anything from the Western world, but in like the Middle East they had a physical copy of these records. Is that
Yeah, so they have to be talking about the actual the manuscripts of the New Testament.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we've got scraps from we actually have scraps from basically all over the Mediterranean world. And I think maybe you came in after this, but basically nobody seriously disputes, other than maybe like the Book of Revelation. Nobody seriously disputes that the New Testament, that anything else in the New Testament was written after 100 AD. But specifically, 1 Corinthians is dated to around 50 or so. And so when we're looking for like the historical boundaries, right? That's where we can start, actually, because Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 is giving a firsthand account. It's a primary source. And we can date that primary source pretty reliably. So, all right. Anything else? I hope this is edifying going into the Christmas season. After we spent so much time talking about the problems and all the arguments, I think this is the clearest, most unequivocal argument for Christianity that I think we have. Now, you have to get people open to the idea of God. Because otherwise they'll just say, well, I still don't believe. There's no evidence that you could show me, right? But for me, this is the clearest, most unequivocal demonstration of the resurrection in history that I know. So let's pray. God, we come before you today thankful for the message of Jesus, that he was, that you rose him from the dead, confirming his message, and God validating our faith in him. And God, I pray that you would give us wisdom, and you would give us grace as we live out the message of Jesus. And Father, I pray that the confidence that we have in Jesus' resurrection would not lead us to arrogance or hubris, but it would lead us to grace and humility, thinking about what you have done for us in Jesus. And Father, knowing that nothing can take Jesus' resurrection away, because it is something that happened in history and we can examine it historically, God. I thank you for that, and I pray that that confidence would stick with us through the rest of this Christmas season. And God, as we finish out our series on apologetics, God, that it would that the confidence and peace that we have through the gospel message would spread out to people around us, and that they would be taken in by the message of Jesus as well. It's in His name that we pray. Amen.